Old Testament reading is from the Song of Songs, chapter 2, beginning at verse 8. Listen, my lover, look, here he comes, leaping across the mountains, bounding over the hills. My lover is like a gazelle or young stag. Look, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, peering through the lattice. My lover spoke and said to me, "Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come with me. See, the winter is past, the rains are over and gone. Flowers appear on the earth, the season of singing has come, the cooing of doves is heard in our land. The fig tree forms its early fruit, the blossoming vines spread their fragrance. Arise, come, my darling, my beautiful one, come with me." The Gospel reading is from Mark chapter 9, beginning at verse 30. They left that place and passed through Galilee. Jesus did not want anyone to know where they were, because he was teaching his disciples. He said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise." But they did not understand what he meant, and were afraid to ask him about it. They came to Capernaum. When he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the road?" But they kept quiet, because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, "If anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and the servant of all." He took a little child and had him stand among them. Taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but the one who sent me." This is the Gospel of Christ. Praise to Christ the Word. I know there are some art lovers in the congregation. I wonder how many of you regularly visit art galleries or do some painting now and then. Well, I have to say my painting skills are somewhat abysmal and my drawing only useful for doodling during otherwise uninteresting moments. But I've learned that it's not that bad, because I've had a few of those moments. I don't regularly frequent art galleries. I haven't even visited the Christchurch Art Gallery yet. The last art gallery we visited was the Auckland one, where we went to an exhibition of Gottfried Lindauer paintings. The enjoyment of art was somewhat marred by the constant vigilance for our children, who were bored and who we had to watch closely, even more so because we noticed that we were watched closely by concerned visitors and staff. I've been to a few art exhibitions since, but not to an art gallery. My most memorable visit to an art gallery was to the Casa de Moneda in Potosí, Bolivia. The art gallery was part of a museum which was housed in the first mint in America. So that's where they made the first coins in South America back in the 16th century. In 1930, the building became a museum and art gallery. It contains a lot of religious art, especially paintings. After wandering through the halls for some hours and viewing the paintings, I came out onto the street, blinked in the sunlight, and was glad that the sun still shone in the sky and that I could breathe the air. After visiting the art gallery, I was still in shock. The paintings had impacted me. They showed suffering and more suffering. From the emaciated figure of Christ suffering not only on the cross, but wherever else that he went, to the vivid portrayals of the suffering of the saints, the paintings portrayed a glorification of suffering. The more cruel the suffering, the more pained the faces, the more afflicted and deprived the bodies, the holier the saints. The ascetic life of negation was at the center of this art, which was mainly from 17th century Spanish and South American painters. Last week's Gospel reading talked about taking up our cross and following Jesus. In today's reading, we heard how Jesus told the disciples,
The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise. Suffering is indeed part of our calling as disciples of Jesus. But that is not everything, and I think that a one-sided seeking of suffering can be dangerous and misdirected. There have been times and places when a theology of suffering was very important in the church. That was to a limited extent the case with the first martyrs when it led to the growth of the church. But in Spanish America, the focus on suffering went alongside cruelty, disregard for others, and a strange guilty pursuit of luxury, as many people realized that they could never reach or endure such heights of suffering. So they left it to the monks and nuns to do that for them. In the second part of our gospel reading, Jesus tells his disciples that those who want to be first must be the very last and servants of all. Following Jesus certainly does not mean the pursuit of status and wealth, but rather servanthood. And Jesus then took a little child and said, "Whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me." Welcoming children may be seen as part of the service of everybody. If in the ancient world children were not well regarded, then welcoming even them would be a sign of humility and servanthood. At least that's the classical interpretation given to that passage. Today I'll suggest something slightly different, but still keeping with it. After all, children were clearly valued in the ancient world and often also treated with affection, as the Bible also portrays. Therefore, at least particularly if we read it together with our Old Testament reading, the welcoming of children may be a balance to an ascetic discipleship. Those following Jesus are not doing it to discover themselves or to separate themselves from human cares. Taking on the cross is not some twisted form of selfish competition about who can suffer most. Rather, as those who follow Jesus, we are called to a deep care for the world and love for God and neighbor. Welcoming a child is an affirmation of life. Welcoming a child is a sign of true humanity instead of calculating social striving. It is also an invitation to delight in the family, to spending time on the little things in life. After all, the Jesus who suffered on the cross was the very one who provided wine for a wedding, who restored children to their grieving parents, who let the children come to him, who was accused of drinking too much. Jesus was a close observer of the beauty of nature, the life of animals and farming rhythms. In this, he followed the tradition of Israel. Jesus certainly was not an ascetic, because Jesus was so involved in the goodness, but also the hurt of life. Exactly because of that, his death was such a giving of his life and truly redemption for humans. The suffering of Jesus is not for suffering's sake, but it is the suffering in the face of a world that has been marred by sin. When we get to our reading from the Song of Songs, we encounter a vitality, a love of life in a joyful and even passionate form. The excerpt that we've read today is actually quite tame in comparison to some of the other parts of the book, which may be somewhat racy even. The inclusion of this book in the Bible has caused some embarrassment to Jews and Christians alike. There is a long tradition of seeing it as an allegory for the soul's mystical union with God or with Jesus. I don't really buy that much into the tradition. I think that the Song of Songs is more about the love between a man and a woman, passionate love at that. It is about longing for each other, about joyful fulfillment, about delight in each other, about physical attraction, even about sex, about beauty, and about how others react to such love. The Song of Songs is in the Bible for a reason. This human love is part of God's gift to humans. It is part of life here on earth. It is a fragile gift, a gift that can be abused and manipulated easily, a gift that makes us vulnerable, a gift that can bring us suffering. But it is also a gift that shows something of God's love for us, a gift that can bring us joy. A wise person I know once observed to me, if you look at it rationally, you'd keep well away from this committed human love and especially from marriage. It gets you into all sorts of trouble. But if you did that, if there was not the sense of falling in love, of romance, then we'd miss out on even more. There's more to life than a purely rational mind could understand. It is little wonder that the joy of love in the Song of Songs is expressed mainly with reference to the extravagant beauty of nature, and particularly of gardens. Human love is like the exuberance of spring as the flowers and blossoms burst forth. They all indicate a zest for life, an enjoyment of beauty and of God's good gifts. That is part of the biblical witness. All this beauty, the swelling over of love and life, is meant to generate in us a response of caring for the lovely and of thankfulness. If the focus on suffering, which is reflected in the Spanish art I saw in Bolivia, is somewhat problematic in view of the Bible, so are other extremes. When I studied Latin literature at university, I also took several courses on the work of Lucretius. Now, Lucretius was probably the most eloquent proponent of the Epicurean philosophy in classical times. Epicurean philosophy stands in stark contrast to any glorification of suffering. At its center is the avoidance of any pain and suffering. Epicureans pursue pleasure. Because of that, they avoid commitment and any involvement that makes them vulnerable and open to hurt. After all, so the Epicureans argued, and that was over 2,000 years ago, after all, we are just a bunch of atoms randomly assembled. There is no direction or purpose in life except for passing these fleeting moments as pleasantly as possible. It is not about eating chocolate and overindulging, as sometimes the Epicureans are depicted today. Rather, they say it is about a self-interested, pleasant life, when we get as much out of life as possible and avoid any sense of suffering, of doubt, guilt, or grief. Indeed, there's quite a bit of Epicurean philosophy in modern life. Now, in all this this depiction of Epicurean philosophy, there was nevertheless one quite beautiful passage in the books of Lucretius. It described the importance that common people attach to some passing joys. So it's nice, but Lucretius saw it negatively. He said that in the poetry, now your joyful home and excellent wife will not welcome you, your sweet children will not come running up to snatch kisses and touch your heart with secret joy. No more will you be able to live prosperously and protect your own. You unhappy man, sadly one hostile day has taken from you all the numerous privileges of life. So people state, but in saying these things, they do not add this, and there now remains left over in you no yearning for these things. We had just read this part of the works of Lucretius in class. And so when I went to the classical department barbecue, I talked with my lecturer who was taking the class on Lucretius. The head of the department joined us. And after some small talk, we came to the studies we were doing. And so the head of the department said, "Ah, yes, Lucretius, there is this lovely passage about a farmer coming home and the children running to welcome him. It's such lovely poetry and encapsulates the sense of home so well." Well, the head of department sauntered on and talked with the next group, and my lecturer said to me, "He really hasn't understood Lucretius at all, has he? Because Lucretius is saying that such moments are meaningless. Indeed, he implies that getting attached to those moments, being so invested in the family, is not the way to embrace pleasure and avoid pain. Lucretius only wrote such a sentimental poem to show the superiority of the Epicurean philosophy." Well, and that is the problem with Epicureanism. In its avoidance of suffering and the pursuit of pleasure, it destroys the goodness and loveliness of life. It rejects the gifts of love and beauty. I think, in contrast, that from a biblical viewpoint, we should treasure the moments of joy. We should observe and protect beauty. Being open to love and life means being vulnerable. Caring for others deeply means that we can be hurt. Appreciating beauty means that its destruction or fading will impact us. Suffering will come to those who lead a life of love. It came to Jesus, but that should not stop us from loving. The Song of Songs, in its celebration of love and beauty, reminds us of God's goodness and calls us to celebrate that goodness as we experience it in human relationships and in the flourishing of nature. The Christian church is sometimes accused of being dour and restrictive, and in part that accusation is justified. However, more central to the church is a sense of joy and of thankfulness. The church has sometimes gone overboard in its restrictions, but sometimes they are justified. After all, they're mainly an effort to protect the beautiful and lovely. Our two readings today focus in particular on valuing children and committed love. In other words, they focus on the family. Through the family, we find something of God's good gifts. Those are certainly not the only gifts that God has given to humans. And the life of many people is full of purpose without a strong family involvement. But we should certainly cherish and care for the gift of family, just as we would care for and cherish a beautiful garden or an outstanding landscape. This also means loving to such an extent that we open ourselves to hurt and to suffering. Cherishing, caring, and being thankful go together. They come from a heart that is grateful towards the creator and sustainer of such goodness. A verse of the hymn, our first hymn that we had, puts it quite well. "For the joy of human love, brother, sister, parent, child, friends on earth and friends above, pleasures pure and undefiled, Lord of all, to thee we raise this our joyful hymn of praise." Even amidst difficulties, even amidst all this uncertainty, even amidst the threat of hurt and suffering, the beauty around us can remind us of God's good gifts and move our hearts to thankfulness.